The Strand Gamers present How We Roll, the show that asks the difficult and largely pointless questions about gamers, their games, and the community that surrounds them. Okay, and we are on with How We Roll. I am joined today by Stan! Exclamation point.
Woohoo!
Stan is the workhorse of the gaming industry.
Wow. You know, I know a lot of people who actually work a lot harder than me, but I'll take that, sure.
Okay. Well, you have been around, you know, we just talked about you worked on Pokemon, D&D, Star Wars, worked for several different companies, as well as maintaining your own little cartoon empire at 10x10 Toons.
Yeah, I get around.
That's 10x10 Toons. I'm sure I'll have a link to it in the show notes.
And I will much appreciate that.
Uh-huh. And we absolutely have to promote your Kickstarter, because I want my book to be in color.
Yes, well, we can do that now if you want.
Sure.
So, as you know, Nick, it's The Littlest Shuggoth, which is a holiday tale of the Cthulhu mythos, a children's book which talks about the Littlest Shuggoth and all the lost city of Relay, who is trying to find his way in the world and requires the help of Santa Claus. It's going on now. It's going to wrap up this Sunday, the 16th of December. We've met our basic funding goal, so the book is going to be published. We're now just on the underside of a stretch goal, which will let me publish it in full color. Originally, I printed it a couple of years back. It was in black and white, and did pretty well, really. Just didn't make enough money to pay for a new printing. And if we can get the color, the next thing I'm pushing for is hardcover. One thing at a time.
Yes. So if you happen to like adorable children's stories or terrible Lovecraftian monsters,
or the intersection between those two,
yes,
very strange intersection.
Yeah, it's an enormous market right there.
Yeah. Well, you know, given how well John Kovalik has done with his My Little Cthulhu over the years, I'm surprised at how big that that overlap actually tends to be. But yeah, so it's you can actually read the whole story online if you want. I've got a new site I just put up specifically for this book. It's littlestshuggoth.com. And on there, the whole story's there. It will remain up. I'm not trying to deprive the world of the story. I'm just trying to give it to people in another form.
Okay. So if that sounds interesting to you, head over to Kickstarter, pledge some money so we can get our books in color and hardcover. I will have a link straight to the Kickstarter in the show notes. But for now, I want to talk to Stan about everything.
All right, my plug out of the way. Let's talk business.
Okay, and we want to talk the business of the gaming business, because you have been around in the gaming community and the gaming industry for a long time.
For a while, yeah. Okay. You know, it's funny. Just last night, I got together with a group of writers and game designers I've known for a long time, and I'm still one of the newbies in that group, but that's, you know, people like Steve Winter and Jeff Grubb, who've been around since the first edition hardcover days. And so, it's interesting to me to sit in this middle point where clearly, with the number of years I've been around, I certainly think that the description of me being a long time game designer fits, but on the other hand, the people I hang around with make me feel like I'm just getting started.
That is how I feel at Perkins Monday Night Games. Like, I'm the baby of that group.
I don't know. Chris Dupuy is at least parallel with you.
Yeah, that's true. He's my companion. We can both miss 70s and 80s references together.
Yay. It's amazing how important 70s and 80s TV is to gaming.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. So you want to get into how you got started?
Well, I started professionally in doing cartooning and writing, and gaming was still just hobby work in the early 80s. And then I had a friend that I knew through the comic book store that I went to in Johnson City, New York. It's Fat Cat Books, so next time I go there, they can give me $5. A friend that I knew was working there wound up getting a job at West End Games, and it was just after they launched Torg, and told us all that they were looking for freelancers. And I'm stopping to be so surprised by it, but you know, a lot of people out there who would make good game designers don't get in because they never find the right pathway. And part of it seems like a form of nepotism, and I guess it is a form of nepotism, but in the end, once the door's open, you've got to prove your way one way or the other. You don't just get in and stay in because you're someone's friend, usually. So anyway, I got access to, knowing what, West End needed and started doing some work with them. Eventually wound up, parlaying that into a staff job. I finished second on a number of openings in the editorial department and wound up getting in sideways in the art department because I happened to have the skills they needed there too. And, from there, went to TSR, which was a pretty quick road to the top of the pile. But TSR at that point was, whenever they had job openings, they'd already gone through everyone they wanted to take from Game Designers Workshop, and they'd turned and fixed their eyes on West End Games. And so suddenly had access to things there that I might not have otherwise, and wound up getting an editorial job, moving to Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, and rode that horse till it fell. I was there through the end of TSR and got invited to come out to Seattle to work for Wizards of the Coast. Went from being an editor to a designer to a creative director in not ridiculously short order, but my skills matched up. One of the interesting things is having come out of teaching and having worked, you know, organizationally outside of gaming, gave me skills that a lot of other people did that put me in position to take advantage of opportunities to move sideways through the companies. And so I wound up being the creative director at one point for all of the D&D worlds. That of course was the late second edition into third edition phase. So most of them were pretty slow, but, still they definitely go on my resume. Worked there until 2002 when I, was caught in the fourth round of layoffs. It's an unhappy series of years, every Christmas time. That's when their financial, books closed. So that's when they did housekeeping, like layoffs. Wound up working down at the, I joined with a couple of other former Wizards people to create the Game Mechanics Incorporated, which is a small design house. We did a lot of D20 modern work and some general D20 work. Worked with published physically with Green Ronin. From there I wound up getting a job at Upper Deck down in Southern California, down in beautiful San Diego County, where I once again joined to be a writer. I was happy to just be a writer. I was happy to go back and just do writing for a while. And there was some shift within the organization. They found that they had a lack of people who could adequately manage the creative staff, and they came to me and asked me if I would want to basically, their term was creative content manager, but basically it was producer or creative director. job. And so knowing my choices were to either take it and do it right or have them put someone in who I knew I didn't think would do it right, I took that job. And stayed with them for a while. And when the time came to part with Upper Deck, I joined the couple people I knew from there to create the Super Genius Games. We do a lot of support for Pathfinder PDF versions. We've been putting out a PDF a week since November of 2009. And we've done support for Call of Cthulhu and Savage Worlds and on occasion odd little projects like my Little Ishtargoth book, just because we can. So I'm still doing that. Last year, for a full year, I worked as a contractor again for Wizards, and that was interesting going back again. I had a very good time, got to see people that I knew and liked working with before and meet lots of new people that I liked working with then, and, you know, suppose, the situations be what they are, if the opportunity came to do that again, I'd certainly take it, but, just because of the way it works, being a contractor, you can only work for so long and then you have to take a rest. And right now, I'm in the middle of my rest. So there's 30 years summed up, just like that.
Okay. Rolling back to something you said at the very beginning, you were talking about, well, game industry nepotism.
Yes.
Where a lot of people don't become designers just because they don't know the right person to get them in the door. Do you think that's still the case in this age of the internet, where I'm sure Wizards gets, you know, submissions and pitches every single day, and every amateur game designer's got their own website?
I don't think it's the same. But I think it's only a little different. See, it used to be geographic, and I think it's not just the game design that gets this. You get this in music too. You wind up with scenes and other arts where someone locally or some group locally will do well, and that leaves openings for other locals to kind of move in and get more attention. You wind up with things like Motown and, Memphis, with the, you know, country music and blues down in Memphis, where you get some place that becomes a hub. And then if you happen to be in that area or know people from that area, you have a better chance of getting seen. Nowadays, it's not so much geographic, as you say, particularly because of the internet, but I think it very much is with the groups of people that you decide to associate with. If you wind up in the circle of people and one of them happens to, break through or have a project that gets noticed or get an opportunity or just, you know, be so brilliant they make it of their own, power, then the chances are that you will have more opportunities than someone who is equally creative to you who does not have those connections. There was a point in time when I thought that was weird for gaming until I started looking and comparing to other industries, like I said, and now it just seems, you know, it's one of those facts of life that who you choose to associate with will have a lot of impact on how your life will go and what successes you'll have. Not to say that you can't do it on your own, but it's easier when you've got the right support.
I kind of feel like that should be, you know, a high school PSA now. Choose your friends carefully.
Yeah, I've had that conversation with friends and friends' kids who are thinking about where to go to college. And, because I look back I went to Binghamton University, which at that point was the State University of New York at Binghamton. And, great school. I got a fantastic education. But the thing that has served me best through that time are the people that I met. And the connections I've had since then, more than any classes or the degree itself, the number of people that I've been able to, call up or I've met in the industry who happen to work there, it's one of those weird little hub places. And, you know, it's the same thing. You see that in the politics, right? You want to go into politics, you'd go to George Washington University or one of the Ivy League universities. You make your, sorry about that. You make your connections, and that's what follows through. And if you don't make them at that point, you're playing catch up until such time as you've got a circle that supports what it is you're trying to do. And it's, I don't know, it sounds really kind of Machiavellian, but, I wouldn't, you know, I've never advised anyone to go simply for the fact that they will be able to exploit that later, but it's something you should be aware of, particularly as you're going out of your school days and into your early career days, is the people that you meet early on are going to be the people that you have access to later on.
You said that you sort of developed a skill set that lets you move your way around in the gaming industry. I'm sure we have a lot of people who are interested in becoming part of the gaming industry, just interested in how it works. What skills did you develop that sort of made you a welcome addition to any company?
Well, so the things that got me in the door fully were actually layout and graphic skills. As I say, I was trying to get a job in the editorial pool at West End in editing and writing, or I got my degree in English literature and rhetoric and all that other fun, useless stuff. I usually like to say I got my degree in advanced book report, because after 4 years I was very well trained to read something and tell you about it. But it was the fact that I had a job working at a local newspaper and learned how to do layout and paste up. And that I had, because I was a cartoonist, I'd learned some design skills, and I knew, the basic programs that they were using at that point. And so, I happened to have those skills, which got me in the door, in the building, and then I was able to, you know, when an assignment came up, we need someone to write an adventure over the weekend. I'll do it. You're right there. And you can get even more advantages than just knowing someone will get you. Once you're there, you can find what they need and help to fill it. And it's a job that also allows you to have an extended tryout. So these days, I would say that, you know, basic publishing and graphic design is still good. Web design, also very good. Sean Reynolds came to TSR originally as their web guy. He managed all the web presence back in the CompuServe days. And again, he played in games with us. He hung out with us and ran some games and got the opportunity to write a couple of adventures and articles. And we were able to see that he was good. And when we had something that had to be done and we didn't know who to go to, we then start turning to him. So those kinds of support skills that you'll often hear game designers say, I don't know anything about web design. They need someone who does.
Mm-hmm. That puts you in shouting range.
Right. Also, let's say we're talking about kind of building connections. If you've got groups of people that you're trying to build, that you want to get in with some of the new up and coming people whose perspective is similar to yours, or you want to get in with some of the small publishers who are doing things you find interesting, coming up to them saying, oh, I can write and do what you do too, is not nearly as alluring as coming up and saying, you know, I can do this other thing which will supplement what you do very well, and start there. And from once you're doing that, and then you're no longer just, the guy who's phoning or emailing in. You are you're Joe, who built our website. And Joe says, hey, you know, I've written this adventure. Would you like to take a look at it? And the answer then is absolutely. And the answer that you'll get back is not likely to be no, if they don't like it. It's, okay, here's what I thought was wrong, and suddenly you have someone who's mentoring you.
Right. Instead of, you know, sending in an email cold that you never get a reply to.
Right.
Like, did anyone read it? No. What's wrong with it? You know, you develop that personal relationship that lets you improve.
Yeah. Yeah. Wizards has, over the last couple of years, taken with the online magazines, that instead of taking submissions all year round, they take submissions in two small windows, but they guarantee that everyone who sends in the submissions will get a reply with a response that gives some detail about why they're getting that response. And while that's having had to take part in that a few times, that's difficult. It also is really it's very valuable for the people out there who are willing to look at what they get and make use of it. That's something, if you're interested in doing it all, work in the gaming industry, do that kind of design, I would say even if D&D isn't your thing, you would be foolish not to try to get some stuff in during their open windows and get the feedback from them and pay attention to what they say. You don't have to agree with it, but you should pay attention to what they say.
Right. And if you can't take criticism, you should abandon all plans of being in the gaming industry, I think.
Yes.
Because no matter what you do, someone is going to hate it, and they're going to post about it on the internet.
Someone's going to love it too, but they may never say anything.
Yeah. You mentioned, you know, even if D&D is not your thing, you should give it a shot. Do you have personal attachments to products you work on, or is it just like they need me to work on Dragonlance today, so that's what I'm doing?
You know, each day by day, you work on what you have to work on, and over time, you know, the longer you work on something, the more attachments you grow to it. Like, I got in at Wizards, I was editor for Ravenloft, and Ravenloft and Dragonlance were in the same creative group, and Dragonlance had just launched the Fifth Age game, the card-based RPG, and they had the core game developed, but the people who did that wanted to get back to working on D&D, so they had a need for someone to write material for that game. And I, personally, I was actually very interested in the card-based game system. I was not a big Dragonlance fan. But, you know, that's where the opening was. So I learned it, and I, you know, I worked with a team of a bunch of people who were very passionate about Dragonlance. And, in the end, I got to care a lot about it. It never will mean for me what it does for other people who got it at the early in their developmental stage, or who it just resonated with, but I have gone from just kind of doing it because that's what I had to do for the job to caring. I now, someone says, "Did you hear about the new Dragonlance thing?" and my ears perk up, which is no end of amusement to my friends from college, because I really didn't like Dragonlance when I was in college. Sorry, Margaret and Tracy.
That's always awkward when you know someone personally.
You know, it's all taste, right? Things are going to resonate with different people different ways.
Yeah.
I never had a bad thing to say about it, except that it wasn't really for me.
Right.
But in the end, now I say I'm as staunch a Dragonlance defender as anyone, because I once you start putting your work and yourself into it, it becomes personal. Certainly having talked with Marvin Tracy and a lot, and Jeff and a lot of the other people who are involved in developing Dragonlance, visions don't always match, but you come to a point where you all understand that everyone everyone has the same passion for the setting and just wants to help to bring it to an audience, to help the audience enjoy it more.
I wanted to talk a little bit about how outside the industry, the gaming community has changed in your time. When did you start? When was your first game?
My first game was in 1978 or 79. I'm going to guess 79. 79 was when I bought my first product, and it was either late in 78 or early 79 that I played. So, a long time ago. And certainly, you know, certainly pre-internet, pre-email, pre-cell phone, one of the differences, I think, all over, cross-gaming and everything, right? The big difference then was how much you were reliant on the people around you. You couldn't just find a group somewhere in the world that is thinking the same kinds of things you are. They're interested in the same things you are. You were limited by what the people around you wanted to do. So, for example, my first few D&D games were with a very small group, and pretty quickly that dissolved in one person getting deeply into sports and another person just kind of having a social meltdown, and another person just kind of, I think, probably finding girls. in any case, we played for a bit, and then that was it. I really didn't play D&D again until college, 4 years later, 3 or 4 years later. And that was because I just didn't know anyone, and I didn't know a way to find anyone that was interested in the game. Today, of course, if you're interested in the game and you get online, you immediately find a network that, even if the people involved in it may come and go, the network itself is probably going to be pretty stable. And if it does start to fall apart, you can find another one. You can find groups of people who are interested in the thing that you want to do now. If you want to play D&D, you can find them. If you want to only play second edition D&D, you can find those people. Right. I got into D&D and was interested in trying some of the other games that were out at the time, but I couldn't even find anyone to play D&D. That was it. There were no other role-playing groups that I knew of.
Yeah. What else was around at the time? I imagine your options have expanded a lot.
Well, at the very beginning, nothing. But, you know, I started seeing the ads for things like Call of Cthulhu and Traveller. I was a big science fiction fan, and I really wanted to try Traveller or any of the other sci-fi games that started coming out in the early 80s. Star Frontiers or Space Opera. But I couldn't find the books myself, and I couldn't find anyone that had any interest in So it just became something that I'd pick up the Dragon magazine on the newsstand or at the comic store and thumb through it and see ads for these cool games that, yeah, I don't know why, but it never occurred to me that I could special order them through that comic store. But I didn't.
Even then you wouldn't have anyone to play with.
Right. Yes. Well, then, you know, at most then I would have had the book to read and I would just be sad. Instead, I let it go. I moved on. And eventually came back and played all those things.
You are making me feel spoiled here, sir. I get to still play with my original gaming group from, 12 years ago, even though we're spread out all over the country.
Yeah, well, and there's a huge advantage for keeping gaming going, right? In my day, when I was getting started, right, if your group split up, there was no way you could keep together over distance. You had to either find a new group or stop playing or play by mail. Forget email, just playing by mail. or the early days of bulletin board systems playing by posts on the BBS sites. I had a friend of mine at college who had his own BBS site, and we had lots of, there was a Traveler game, and there was a Villains and Vigilantes game. There were probably three or four Villains and Vigilantes games. There were a couple of Star Trek games. There's one paired off Star Trek game where one was the Federation and one was the Romulans, and the same guy was running the two systems. And so the Romulans could see what was going on the Federation board. They had spies, and so they could see what we were doing, and we couldn't see what they were doing. It was pretty cool. And it felt so futuristic. certainly, as the technology gets better and better for playing online, the ease of map programs and Skype and Google Plus, it just becomes less and less likely that someone who wants to continue gaming, a group that wants to continue gaming and has the time, can do it no matter where in the world they go. Time is something that hasn't changed. Right? What happens as you get from beyond school and into working, you know, schedules and then
babies,
children, and I don't think we found a solution to life, but the distance, I think we're pretty close to overcoming.
You mentioned gazing longfully at Call of Cthulhu. You a Lovecraft fan even then?
I wasn't. I was more of a fan of 30s and Victorian era stuff and this kind of investigation. I was a Holmesy kind of guy.
Yes.
So
man after my own heart.
The first time I got to play Call of Cthulhu, I was a little unhappy because it was old school Call of Cthulhu where at the end of every session everyone died. It was cataclysmic Cthulhu. I think that in the last 10 years, 10 to 15 years, the best innovation in Cthulhu gaming is the idea that you can have, that it's okay to have campaign play. That as long as it's building towards a Lovecraftian, Cthulhuian ending, you don't have to have madness and horror descend at the end of each 4 hours.
Well, I think gaming, tabletop gaming as a whole has taken that trend. I mean, when I think about something like Tomb of Horrors, if I had a DM try to pull, an old school Tomb of Horrors on me, I would flip the table on him.
Like, so here, interestingly, one of the first games I ever got to play through was at summer camp back in 78 or 70, must have been 79. That was the only module that the DM had. There were two or three of us that played. And so he adapted that into a more survivable version. He kitbashed it, gave us extra NPCs and, the equivalent of do-over chips. And tweaked it. Even back then, you could do that, but you're right. Those kind of games were built as tournaments and contests, and that doesn't go along very well with the idea of a campaign.
Right. It was still pretty close to its roots in wargaming.
Yeah.
We've taken huge strides towards being far more about storytelling.
The first product I ever owned for D&D was, I couldn't get the box set or the player's handbook. The monster manual, the player's handbook wasn't even out yet. I just couldn't find them, but I could find the official Dungeons and Dragons coloring album. There's a period of time in the late 70s when coloring books for adults became hot for about 8 months, and Dungeons and Dragons had one produced. It had fiction by Gary Gygax in it, and large, intricate pages for coloring with D&D monsters. But it also had a board game in the center that you could play. And between the story and the board game set my personal thought on what D&D was supposed to be. And that was very story-centric. It was a lot more of a story game than the modules like Tomb of Horrors would lead you to believe. And I think there are a lot of people out there who, for lack of access to all the stuff, got that, you know, this being based on Tolkien and epic stories, that what you had was something that was supposed to be long and continuing story, and it came as something of a surprise to find out that the official material was all very abrupt and ended more often with grisly failure and lots of laughs.
Right. And even the longer campaigns were not so much story-based as just mega dungeons.
Right, right. Like,
you could survive it, but you're going to be playing in this dungeon for 2 years. You're making me think that the earliest D&D designers didn't know what game they were making. Or at least they weren't making the game the fans wanted them to make.
Yeah, well, you know, it needed to develop that that background of shared understanding, you know, the common language that we now can use in building our story-based games and story-based adventures. I don't know that. Well, in fact, I'm certain that if someone tried to do something like that in the early 80s, it would not have come out looking like what we expect story-based adventure to look like now. In fact, you'd have things. You go back and look at some of the Judges Guild stuff, the city-state of the Invincible Overlord. Basically, is a big sandbox that you can run a campaign out of, but you go to it now, and it doesn't have what we want it to, but at that time, it was the storytelling product of its era. Now it's just a bunch of lists and stats and maps.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh, you
I think that's before my time.
Overlord, there's a group called the Judges Guild, which was a small press organization, or you know, just a group of game designers who put out stuff that was unofficial D&D products. They were the first group to kind of get slapped with the cease and desist because they were putting out D&D products, just because they thought it was cool and it would be helpful to the game. And they put out a bunch of interesting things, but for me, the key was always this product called the City State of the Invincible Overlord, which was a large city, medieval city, very detailed on the maps and the NPCs and what was going on in the city. But it was very first edition. It was really just a whole slew of small type with stats and broken sentences and half-finished ideas. But it was completely different from the other stuff that was going on. And eventually, I think Mayfair redid it as a box set in the mid-80s, which is probably easier to find looking on eBay and such. From where I sit, it was the storytelling product of its era. And yet, if you look at it now and show it to people who are interested in story, they would laugh at that compared. It's not at all that by what we call that today.
And they were actually small press publishers who were actually publishing physical products.
But yes, mm-hmm. They're still around. I think they came. They put a bunch of their stuff back into print now. Game Science carries them. I think that's certainly where I see it at Gen Con.
That's just staggering to me that there was a market large enough even then for.
Well, but you think about again going back to the history of gaming coming out of the wargaming, the D&D was a supplement for Wargaming that Gary and Dave worked together to put out. And there was just this history of you made products, you made little games or little add-ons to products, and you shared it with people at conventions. The earliest Gen Cons were basically getting together and play, and you know, to share these mimeographed copies of your version of here are some rules for having specific heroes in the game as opposed to just random characters. So here's my set of new monsters. You can put fantasy monsters in your Napoleon miniatures games. One of the things that back then, again, without the internet, you had things were very regional. The center of the U.S., the Ohio, Minnesota area where D&D grew up was probably the strongest, but there was also a very strong West Coast group and a strong Northeast group. And, you went from area to area. They were playing very different things. And so someone goes to the Midwest to play at a convention and comes back with a couple of these mimeographed small booklets saying, "Oh, look what I found when I was out in Ames, Iowa." And suddenly people are copying that and doing different takes on it. And suddenly it's growing in a slightly different way in the Northeast. And people on the West Coast are only hear about it. And so someone says, "I can make that up and make something that's completely different, but is inspired by what they've heard that the people in the Northeast are doing." Back before there was the ready communication, that's what game community was. And as Gen Con was, you actually came to have a single convention that people could go to. That's when the kind of cross-seeding and I don't want to say homogenization because that has a negative ring to me about it. Kind of everyone getting on very similar pages and being able to share their material back and forth and create a larger single gaming community came out of that.
What's fascinating to me is now that we're moving in the opposite direction. Now that we have the global community that we can all share, and you know, anyone can come up with a custom module and put it online for anyone in any part of the world. What's happening now is we're actually dividing deeper into factions.
Yeah, it's one of the things that was done very purposefully with third edition as a business decision. So kind of take a step back. In late second edition, one of the things you had, because of the way the rules creep had gone and the different, official ways you could do various things depending on which books you were using, was if you played in a D&D group and you went to a new city to play in another D&D group, you couldn't be sure that you knew all the rules you'd need. Each group and often it would kind of permeate an area, would have, specific tendencies for house rules or kind of the agreed upon, this is how we're going to do this. And it was different from city to city and region to region. And so with third edition, there was a concerted effort on the brand team to create a broader level of agreed upon basic tenets of the game. So that if you went to a game, no matter where you went in the world and you sat down to play a D&D game, you would be playing the same game. I think that they pushed that a little too hard and the community bought into it a little too deep. And it went from being what I think was a very good idea to have that base game that was going to be the same no matter where you went to being very hidebound on this is the correct way to play. And if you're not playing this way, then you're playing wrong. And it really empowered rules lawyerism and putting down the ability for smaller designers or small publishers to put out ancillary material that would be accepted by the broader audience. The number I can tell you certainly as someone who's been involved in two companies that produce third-party material, the biggest challenge is that most of the people playing both D&D and Pathfinder have the opinion that if it's not from the core publisher, then it's not worth using. And that may be right for in some cases. It may even be right in most cases, but it denies you the ability to look at something interesting that someone's done that may appeal just to what you want to do. If you're going to turn your back on everything that's not produced by the core group. It also sets up two really opposite problems. One is that the game company can't put out product fast enough to suit everyone's needs. Like, you can't get everyone's corner case bit of game design they want, and they put out way too much stuff trying to accomplish that. And you have between that the problem that Pathfinder faced early on, where they had one big book, and if you wanted something new that was going to be official, you pretty much had to wait a year or two till they got the next book out. And D&D in 4th edition, just, you know, they had the money, they had the resources, and they put out hardcover books every month. And it was more than anyone could possibly process.
It's kind of funny talking about, you mentioned in 3rd edition they push too hard on that, the homogenous aspect. I don't think Wizards really learned their lesson on that one. Because the first seasons of Encounters, one of their basic premises was, you can go to any game store, sit down in Encounters and play on a Wednesday, and then next week you could fly across the country, go to another game store, and sit down, and it'll just be the continuation of what you played in any other store. The idea that you could pass back and forth and move your character, and everything would be completely homogenous between groups. And I think it took several seasons of Encounters for Wizards to realize that that doesn't work because it completely eliminates any player input.
It eliminates player input, and I think that people, particularly people who wind up working in games, do so because we like to play games. And we like to play different games, and we like to play with different groups. But most of the hobbyists out there, most gamers, like to play with their group. And only occasionally go and play with other groups. They're not jumping around the country and playing, you know, 1 week Encounters in Minneapolis, and the next week in Birmingham, Alabama. They're playing with their group, and they go to the store and they have their group they're going to play with for the next 8 weeks. And given the choice, they're not going to want to sit at a new table with new people. They're going to want the same people they played with. And a lot of that is because of the social nature of gaming and the feeling of continuity in a storytelling game. But that's just, in my opinion, or it appears to me, that's how most people want to play the games. And so all of the ideas for creating these larger ability to make gaming accessible no matter where you go, I don't think that they come from a bad thought, but they go too far without realizing the practical implications of how most people are going to use the material.
Do you think there's a case of ivory tower where game designers don't interact enough with people outside the industry to realize what they want?
I think you can look at it that way, but I don't think that's really what it is, because the people that I play with in the game industry are very much like the people that I chose to play with in my local group. I think it's whether it was in Binghamton or on Long Island or in Seattle here at Wizards of the Coast, the type of people that are in my group, the type of people I enjoy game with are the same, and they are the people who like to try different things. I had my groups, no matter where I was, were groups that would try different campaigns and different games, and a new one would come out and someone would read it so that we could play it 3 weeks later. And it took me a while to realize in interacting with other fans and other gamers that their home groups weren't like that. I think that the people who wind up getting into gaming professionally, the game design professionally, come from groups like that, and it's not so much that they get to the company and are in an ivory tower. It's that they grow out of a subset of gamers, and they don't, they just don't get it. I know back in, again, with my college group, we didn't understand the other groups that wouldn't want to play other games or try a board game one night or make changes to the game one week, see how it went, and then just change it back. We're constantly making, different house rules and trying different things with the games to dial them in. That was just part of the fun of it. But the other groups that I would meet at the game store, the other people I would talk to who weren't in my gaming groups, didn't want any of that. They just wanted to go and play their Paladin or whatever. And they didn't want to try going and playing a Space Ranger or going and playing a superhero. So I think that professional game designers kind of grow up in an ivory tower. And then they just kind of come together to a new tower.
Well, that seems like an interesting message to go out on.
I don't know. It's not always true. And I know that we, at Wizards now, and certainly over the years since I joined TSR, there has been a greater and greater emphasis on going out and interacting with the public. But, I think that there's, if anything, as much frustration drawn from that as there is insight. And the frustration is, well, we want to try all these cool things and they just want to do the same old thing. And that was cool, but here's another thing. This might be cooler. And it's difficult to get interest in on a broad scale for that. And that's the thing that a company like Wizards survives on, is the broad scale. If you're a small publishing company, if you're an independent designer or a small company, you can go for the smaller groups that want to try these different things, but you got to realize that your audience is limited by that. And I think that, certainly knowing what you do and the kind of people that I'm guessing are listening to your show, most of them are the kind of people who want to do that too. Like, they're interested in trying new things. But I think that if you look at it, I suppose I can ask you, do you think that most of the people you've seen at game stores and the places you've gone have had the same kind of adventurous take on trying new things that you do?
Absolutely not. I mean, I see people, they'll play one game or one type of game and try to be like the best at it by whatever metric they use for that. Make the best kick-ass character or the most interesting personality, but they want to do that one game very well and they don't want to change.
Yeah, I think that's the attitude that is usually absent from the people who are, who get into game design. And we relish having other people like that feel the same way we do around us and trying new things and pushing envelopes. And, it's easy to forget that when you go back out in the world, most of the people out there don't want their envelopes pushed.
Okay. I think I've picked your brain enough and we compressed the last 30 years of your experience into an hour. we should plug your Kickstarter again, the little shog off.
Before the December 16th is the last day for the Littlest Shoggoth Kickstarter. You can go to littlestshoggoth.com or to the Kickstarter site. There's also a Facebook fan page. I'm doing everything I can to get it out there.
Yeah. You're even slumming it on this show, so you must be desperate.
Well, a little desperate. Plus, I like hanging out with you.
I like hanging out with you too, Stan.
Aw.
Anything else you want to plug? Your blog, your cartoons, Super Genius Games?
Super Genius Games, like I say, I've talked about them a bit. If you're playing Pathfinder or just generic third edition style OGL stuff, we've got 175 plus products out there. They're pretty cheap and worth giving a look. Owen Casey Stevens, who's a former Wizards designer, is our lead designer and is producing a lot of really interesting envelope pushing kind of material.
I have to ask, do you keep him chained to a wall with some sort of stimulants or something? How is he possibly that prolific?
He keeps himself chained. The answer is he has a wife and a mortgage, and he makes his living writing. There's nothing like gut-level fear to keep your fingers flying on the keyboard. Also, he lives in Oklahoma, so it's easier to make a living wage as a freelance game designer.
Plus, there's nothing else going on.
Yes, well, you know, he doesn't seem to think that's exactly true. But pretty much.
Okay, well, thank you very much for joining us, Stan.
All right, thank you, Nick, and I'll see you Monday.
Yeah, I'm sure I will try to have you on again because you are fantastic at talking.
It's one of the things I'm good at. And I'll be happy to come on anytime.